Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Here is a special announcement. Today is Tuesday, and not, as is announced in today's Sunday Telegraph, Friday. And now, a repeat of last Thursday's performance of Monday Night is Music Night.
Well, here we are again together for an evening under lamplight on Cambridge 105 Radio with Robert Louis Abrahamson. We'll be attending to a Greek myth about a river deity, Arethusa, whom you may have heard of, but probably haven't. Hers is one of those myths that give us a story fascinating in itself and also rich in mythic suggestions. Come along, you're invited to attend. On the last show, you will recall, I read the modern fairy tale The River Maid by Jane Yolen, a story about one of those modern men who think they can control everything for their own gain, a man who forces the river to alter its course to fit his own personal gain. And there, in the muddy channel where the river used to flow, he sees a beautiful maiden, a water sprite, whom he carries home and imprisons in his house for almost a year. He knows she's in pain and longs for her freedom, but he convinces himself that this is okay and hardens his heart further against what he's doing. And he cannot resist touching her, and then touching her more, and finally impregnating her. And when the spring comes, and she is ready to give birth, her waters break just as the river, now raging with the waters of snow melt, breaks its banks and returns to its original course, washing away the man's house and the man himself. And now things go on as before, the man and his pollution wiped off the face of the earth. Except for that hybrid creature the river maid gave birth to, sometimes seen beneath the waters of the river. If you want to hear the full story, go back to the archives at momentsunderlamplight.co.uk, following the Evening Under Lamplight link, and click on the previous show called There, Tricksters, Heroic and Abusive. Now, I wanted to follow that reading with another story about a mythic figure associated with water. And so let's turn to the myth of Arethusa, a story full of uncertainty, like a river, in fact. Is it a story of cruelty, or perhaps of successful escape, or of maturing out of adolescence, or what? Well, hold on and we'll see, maybe. But first, let's look for a minute at rivers and the myth of river gods. And where else to go but T.S. Eliot's four quartets? Just after the passage about there being a time for the evening under lamplight, Eliot starts the third quartet, Dry Salvages, with a little discussion about the gods of rivers. "I do not know much about gods," he says, "but I think that the river is a strong brown god." Here's Alec Guinness reading these 14 lines. Catch what you can from his reading, and then we'll attend a little further. So, "I do not know much about gods."
"I do not know much about gods, but I think that the river is a strong brown god, sullen, untamed, and intractable, patient to some degree, at first recognized as a frontier, useful, untrustworthy as a conveyor of commerce, then only a problem confronting the builder of bridges. The problem once solved, the brown god is almost forgotten by the dwellers in cities, ever, however, implacable, keeping his seasons and rages, destroyer, reminder of what men choose to forget, unhonored, unpropitiated by worshippers of the machine, but waiting, watching, and waiting. His rhythm was present in the nursery bedroom, in the rank ailanthus of the April dooryard, in the smell of grapes on the autumn table, and the evening circle in the winter gaslight.
So what's going on here? Eliot says he doesn't know much about gods. Who, especially today, does know much about gods? But he's willing to open himself to the idea that the river is a god. In other words, that there is some kind of divinity in a river, a kind of personality there, far different from our human personalities, sullen, untamed, and tractable. We cannot control this deity any more than Jan in The River Maid could control the river, or the river maid, whom he thought he had successfully imprisoned in his house, but who burst out of human confinement. I've always liked the recognition that rivers were, at first, recognized as a frontier, a boundary marking off divisions of landscape. Migrating people, or hunters, came to a river and were stopped. End of the path. But then people discovered its uses, and although it was untrustworthy, the river was good for commerce. You could transport goods, especially heavy goods like timber or stone. It became then only a problem confronting the builder of bridges. Just an obstacle that human technology could get the better of, and then was forgotten. The problem once solved, Eliot says, the brown god is almost forgotten by the dwellers in cities. But the river is still there, ever implacable, keeping his seasons and rages, destroyer, reminder of what men choose to forget, unhonored, unpropitiated by worshippers of the machine. Who wants to give reverence to a mere river when we have machines that we can worship instead? But the river is waiting, watching and waiting. And the rhythm, the nature energy of the river, can be felt by young children, by the flowers in the garden, by the food on the table. And, Eliot adds, taking us back to that evening under lamplight, and the rhythm can be felt in the evening circle in the winter gaslight. Those moments of stillness when we forget our machines and devices and find ourselves open to the energy of nature. Perhaps not quite worshipping the river as a god, but in a position, well, in a position nearly to do so. And let's have a song about someone who has not forgotten the dirty old river as he sits alone at night, apart from the people so busy and taxi lights shining so bright, comforted in his solitude by gazing on the sunset over the river. And isn't this, in its way, a communion with the river god? I don't feel afraid. As long as I gaze on Waterloo sunset, I am in paradise. You know the song, don't you?
Feel dizzy, taxi
There's been a lot of discussion about who exactly this Terry and Julie are crossing over the river, but it doesn't matter. They too, it seems, remember the river god. They have each other, but they too need no friends as long as they gaze on Waterloo sunset. They too are in paradise. The Kinks, Waterloo Sunset, of course, a song that connects to the kind of mythic view of rivers T.S. Eliot was talking about. If only by personifying the river and recognizing the superhuman properties of this personified river. As long as I gaze on Waterloo Sunset, I am in paradise. There's something divine about that river, even if Ray Davies Darin come right out and say it. So the first step towards this mythologizing is personifying, imagining the personal features in natural phenomena. The River Thames at sunset, personified as a soiled but steady and steadying presence. Dirty old river, just you keep rolling, rolling into the night. But now back to our main story of the evening, the myth of Arethusa. Here's what I think we'll do. Let me first read you Ted Hughes's loose and lively translation of Ovid's version of the story, and then we can go back over it, attending to what catches our attention. Arethusa is the deity of a famous spring and river in Sicily, but she did not originate there. The goddess Ceres, or Demeter, comes to the pool where Arethusa's water springs up and asks Arethusa to come up and tell her how she came to be present in this guise. Ted Hughes picks up the story here. The pool grew calm as the goddess rose out of the depth. She gathered up her green hair, and from it, wringing the heavy water, began the old story of how she was loved by a river. I was a nymph of Achaia. None loved the woods and setting their hunting nets as keenly as I did. I was all action and energy, and never thought of my looks. Even so, my looks, yes, my beauty, made others think of me. The fame of my appearance burdened me. The attractions that all the other girls were sick to have sickened me that I had them. Because they attracted men, I thought them evil. Well, there came a day I had exhausted myself in this Stymphalian forest. The heat was frightening, and my efforts, harrying the game, had doubled the heat's effect on me. I found a stream, deep but not too deep, quiet and clear. So clear, every grain of sand seemed magnified. And so quiet, the broad clarity hardly dimpled. The poplars and willows that drank at it were doubled in a flawless mirror. I waded in, foot soles, ankles, knees, then stripped, hung my clothes on a willow, and plunged. As I played there, churning the surface, to and fro, diving to the bottom, swimming on my back, my side, my belly, I felt a strange stir bulge in the current. It scared me so badly, I scrambled up to the bank. A voice came after me. Why leave in such a hurry, Arethusa? It was Alpheus in the swirl of his waters. Why leave in such a hurry, he cried again. I saw my clothes on the willow across the river. I had come out on the wrong bank. Naked as I was, I just ran. That brought him after me all the more eagerly. My nakedness, though it was no invitation, gave his assault no option. I was like the dove in a panic, dodging through trees when the hawk rides its slipstream tight as a magnet. The peak of Orchomenus went past, and Sophis. They were stepping stones that my feet barely touched. Then Cyllene, and the napped flinty ridges of Menalas, Erymathus, and Elis. The map rolled under me as in a flight in a dream. He could not overtake me, but he could outlast me. Over savannas, mountains black with forest, pathless crags and gorges, but soon the sun pressed on my back, and I saw that I ran in a long and leaping shadow, the very shape of my terror, and I heard the stones flying from his striding feet and his panting breath that seemed to tug at my hair. In an agony of effort, I called to Diana, "Help, or it's all over with me. Remember how I carried your bow, your quiver full of arrows? Help me, help me, oh, help me!" The goddess heard and was stirred. She brought up a dense mist and hid me. I smothered my gasping lungs. I tried to muffle my heartbeat, and I froze. I could hear the river god Alpheus blindly casting about. Twice he almost trod on me where I crouched under the deep weeds. "Arethusa!" he kept shouting. "Arethusa!" As if I would answer. You can imagine what I was feeling, what the lamb feels when the wolf's jaws are ripping the edge of the shed door, or what the hare feels peering through the wall of grass blades when the circling hounds lift their noses. But Alpheus persisted. Circling the clump of mist, he could see clearly my track that had gone in and had not come out. When I understood this, a sudden sweat chilled my whole body. It streamed from me. It welled from my hair. It puddled under my feet. In the time it takes to tell you this, I had become a spring, a brisk stream, a river flowing away down the hillside. But the river god recognized me, and he too dissolved his human shape and mingled his current with my current. But Diana helped me again. She split earth open. I dived into the gorge, and underground I came to Ortygia, this land which bears the name of my own beloved goddess, brought me back to light. This is my story.
See the water flow. Oh, wizard of changes, water, water, water. Dark or silvery, mother of life. Water, water, holy mystery, heaven's daughter. Wizard of changes, teach me the lesson of flowing. Through. Oh, wizard of changes, teach me the lesson of flowing. song when the world was new. Water's laughter sings it through. Wizard of changes, water, water, water.
That was the incredible string band giving us the water song to close out the Ted Hughes version of the Arethusa myth. An odd song, perhaps not to everyone's taste, but part of that celebrated 1968 album, The Hangman's Beautiful Daughter. And this is Evening Under Lamplight, coming to you on Cambridge 105 Radio with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson. We're attending to the myth of Arethusa, so let's get back to our story, but first...
When the day comes to an end, he invites you to attend. Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105 Radio. When the day comes to an end, he invites you... No. When the day comes to an end, he invites you to attend. It's Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105 Radio. It's Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Thank you, Neil Henry. Now, like so many of the characters in Greek mythology, there are several different accounts of who Arethusa was. But all accounts agree that she was a water nymph, that is, a kind of minor divinity, not immortal, but living for a long time. She's always associated with water in one way or another. But when we see her in this story, she seems to have forsaken her watery associations and joined the band of young women who followed Artemis or Diana, the virgin goddess of the hunt. And this identifies her character right away. In Greek mythology, the followers of Artemis were young maidens who came together to hunt and play games together, interested in these pursuits and not concerned with men. This wasn't a lesbian group, though. They were unconcerned with any kind of sex. They were the kind of adolescents who are interested in sports, passionate about sports, and seek no diversion through flirting or sexual attraction. If you were with Artemis, you were sworn to virgin purity. And in this sense, they can represent any of us, young virgins or not, who are so passionate about whatever interest we pursue, whether hunting or music or writing or even things like computer games, that we have no interest in anything not related to our passion. Today we might call these people nerds. But in Greek mythology, they're represented as lithe, innocent young maidens. And often, as in the case of adolescents in myths and fairy tales, their story is a coming-of-age story. Let's see if this happens with Arethusa as well. Arethusa gives us a little account of herself, setting us up for what's about to happen. She was entirely given over to the pleasures of hunting, none more devoted than she. But she was also beautiful, and celebrated for her beauty, but she would have nothing to do with that. She blushed in shame when people praised her beauty, and went so far as to think it a disgrace to be so attractive to others. She wanted nothing but the purity of a life of sport. But life's not always so pure like that. Now, the stories about these virginal followers of Artemis usually begin when the young devotee of hunting is alone, hunting far and wide, and then, hot and tired, seeks some refreshment in a cool body of water in a shady place. And thus with Arethusa. If we bother to calculate distances from the details Ovid gives us, she has wandered that day 60 miles away from her home. And she is drawn to what is traditionally called a locus amenus, an idyllic spot, with an inviting stream with clear, still, silent waters and tall trees to shade the spot. Peter Jones reminds us that in Ovid's Metamorphoses, the attractiveness of such scenes is nearly always deceitful. Gods are everywhere, and the more peaceful and secret the location, the greater the hidden danger of stumbling across a deity unawares and paying the price. Arethusa is fooled into thinking this is a safe place. She first dips her toes in and then steps further up to the knee. But that's not enough. It just invites her to plunge deeper, and she strips off her clothes and, in a lovely touch, hangs them carefully on an overhanging branch. And then, nudaque mergor aquis. There's some of the original Latin for you. Naked, I am covered by the waters. And she's having a good time, relaxed and careful, swimming, dancing, in fact, in the river. But then comes the threat. Suddenly, some mysterious sound, a vibration, a murmur, she can't tell what, comes from the midst of the stream. She's terrified and jumps out of the water onto the riverbank. It's the personified god of the river causing this fright. It's the river Alpheus, and its god, of course, is called Alpheus. And he takes on his human shape, calling to her, "Where are you rushing off to, Arethusa? Where are you rushing off to?" What would you do in this situation? What would you do if you were young and innocent like Arethusa? Well, she took off in the opposite direction. But oops, she had jumped out of the river on the side opposite to the side where she'd hung her clothes. So, sicut eram, fugio sine vestibus. Just as I was, I run off without clothing. She's aware that running nuda like this will just inflame this man even more. It doesn't seem in Ovid's account that she blames him. Men are like that. And remember, she, for some reason, felt ashamed of being attractive. That old oppressive game of making the woman feel guilty about arousing men's passions. Ovid describes her flight over miles and miles and miles, about 105 miles if we're counting. She's athletic and can keep ahead of Alpheus, but he has the greater stamina, and she knows he'll eventually catch up to her. In fact, now the sun is getting lower in the sky and she's heading eastwards, she's horrified to see his long shadow on the ground ahead of her. Or she says maybe it was just fear that made her imagine this. And then she can hear his footsteps right behind and feel his breath in her hair.
I know you.
course, Martha and the Vandellas, nowhere to run. Not quite the same situation as Arethusa's, but similar enough, and full of that desperate energy Arethusa must have been feeling. Actually, let's stop a second and attend to that song. There are some amazing images there. She knows he's no good for her, but she says there's nowhere to run or hide from him. Not physically, like Alpheus pursuing Arethusa, but the thought of him in her mind or her heart, that's what she can't run away from. Each night as I sleep, into my heart you creep. When I look in the mirror to comb my hair, I see your face just a-smiling there. Now that's obsession, even a kind of demon possession, overmastering her. Oh yes, and this is for percussion people like Henri listening in. The Funk Brothers were using snow chains along with the tambourine and drums to give the music that extra kick. Well, so there's Arethusa, fessa labora fugae, as Ovid says, worn out from the work of fleeing. And in her last resort, she calls out to her patron, the goddess Artemis, or Diana. Help me out of this, she cries. I was your special armor-bearer. Don't let me be defeated here. And the goddess comes to her immediate aid. Suddenly a thick cloud appears and surrounds and hides Arethusa. This baffles Alpheus, who's standing right there. Where's she gone? He walks around the cloud a few times but can't see her, and he calls out, Yo, Arethusa! Yo, Arethusa! Which conveniently can be translated as, Yo, Arethusa! Yo, Arethusa! Where are you? As if she would answer him. Arethusa is frozen to the spot in fear. And whether she starts sweating because of all the running or out of fright, the divine magic of the moment works on that sweat, which falls as blue-green drops because that's the color of water nymph's sweat. Her whole body is perspiring. Water is trickling from her hair, and there are puddles accumulating at her feet. And faster than it takes to tell you this, her body has been transformed into water. But wait, Alpheus is a water divinity too, and he can still recognize her and is still attracted. And he returns to his watery form so he can now mingle with her waters, and somehow he thinks this will satisfy his lust. But Artemis is on top of things and opens up a crack in the earth down through which Arethusa, in watery form, seeps, and flowing under the earth, comes up again into daylight, far away in Syracuse, in Sicily. And that's how the famous Pool of Arethusa came to be.
Thank you.
That was Benjamin Britten's interpretation of Arethusa from his Six Metamorphoses after Ovid. Just one oboe flowing through this short piece. And so, looking back over the story, what do we think? We have first had a run-through of the story with Ted Hughes's lively retelling, and then we went back over the story, pausing to flesh out the details. And now it's a good idea to reflect over the things that might have stood out for us as we've attended to the story. One thing we can't miss, I suppose, is Ovid's voyeurism. It's characteristic of him to delight in pictures of alluring women enjoying the titillation. After all, he first made his literary reputation as an elegant, erotic poet. And in his masterpiece, The Metamorphoses, a work in 15 books, each book consisting of 500 or 600 lines, in The Metamorphoses, many of the episodes are also erotic, usually, not always, about men, or gods mostly, having their way over women or nymphs or goddesses. His Roman understanding of things saw the world as often cruel and unfair, without a lot of compassion, and the best way to deal with it was to treat things as wittily as possible, enjoying what pleases us, making the best of the pains and horrors. Look, after all, when later in his life the Emperor Augustus banished Ovid for reasons that have never been quite clear, banished him to the ends of the empire where there was no one to share his sophisticated tastes. Well, he managed his grief by composing poems about his exile. Not cheerful, witty poems exactly, but strong and passionate works, and ending with a compassionate passage addressed to his wife, thanking and praising her for her loyalty to him in his exile, and hoping that through his praise of her in his poetry, her fame would last as long as his books did. And so it has. Yes, Ovid's world is cruel, but not always. And here, in the story of Arethusa, we have a rare example of the young woman escaping the god's advances. Sisterhood proves stronger than male aggression.
Say every man must fall.
That was Miriam Makeba with Tula Sizwe, a South African song of hope for release and freedom, followed by Dylan's I Shall Be Released. Also an example of sisterhood, also featuring Nina Simone. Capturing perhaps the confident prayer of Arethusa granted by her patron Artemis. Now, on the mythic level, we see that when Arethusa, turned into the stream, seeps under the ground, she's experiencing a mythic death experience, chthonic, as the Greeks would say, the kind of underworld experience all heroes must pass through in their epic journeys. This underworld death becomes the mythic symbol for the rite of passage leading to maturity. And so we can understand Arethusa as being led to rebirth, transformation, a new life in her own form. We saw her as an innocent girl, separated from her group of girlfriends, innocently entering the river for enjoyment, and then suddenly encountering, or stirring up, we might even say, a strong, worldly energy that wants to possess her. This is her calling to leave the comforts she had known and move on into a deeper existence through that terrifying initiation as she moves into what Joseph Campbell calls a dream landscape of curiously fluid, ambiguous forms. Fluid, indeed. This whole story is pervaded with the element of water and shape-shifting, rivers, clouds, sweating, puddles, underground streams. And after the death experience, Arethusa comes out changed, not terrified anymore, but at least as Ovid tells it, composed and sure of herself. It's important to attend to the tone in which Ovid has her tell her own story. First of all, she has her own voice. She can tell her story in her own way. She doesn't have to have some male narrator doing the telling for her. And the tone in which she tells the story is frank, calm, perhaps even smiling. And let's not forget the lovely early detail. After Demeter comes to the pool and asks Arethusa to tell her story, notice it's all set as one woman talking to another, Arethusa rises up out of the water and first wrings out the water from her hair, her green hair, because she's a water deity. The hair represents the reeds and other plant life under the water. This is a wonderful gesture that only someone who's in command of herself would think of doing. A gracious gesture of respect to the other person, not to look disheveled in her presence. She speaks in a relaxed way. When she describes how still the waters of Alpheus's river are, she says it was so free from ripples that you could count every pebble on the riverbed. And it was so still that, well, you'd hardly think it was flowing at all. She's able to understand what motivates her male pursuer. He was so aroused by seeing me and chased me with such ardor, quia nuda fui, sum vis paratiorili. Because I was naked, it seemed as though I was ready for him. She doesn't judge him. I think she's just, now in her maturity, just smiling ruefully at the mistake, awful though it was, that prompted him to get so excited. That's men for you. What more can she say? It was a trick of ill luck that led her to abandon herself to the delights of the refreshing water. That's the way the world is. Tricks and misfortunes everywhere. And then that horror scene climax, when, running away into the east, she sees that the sun is casting Alpheus' long shadow up ahead of her, an image the best horror film directors would be glad to use. We don't see the man coming up close behind her, we just see his shadow growing bigger in front of her. But she's no longer frightened by this as she tells the story, and she can add, Nisi si timor illa videbat. She saw the shadow in front of her, unless it was my fear that made me see it. Her tone speaks to us not just of her maturity, but of her attainment to a serenity that has fulfilled her, as she no longer just runs around hunting and killing animals, but now serves her people with this living water flowing out from her throughout the land. So let's take a break and listen to Cheng Yu on the classical Chinese pipa or lute with a piece called Flowing Water from High Mountain. Flowing Water from High Mountain by Cheng Yu. Arethusa's Fulfillment. In other versions of the Arethusa story, Alpheus manages to follow her down that crevice in the earth, and he succeeds in mixing his waters with hers, over there in her new place in Sicily. But things have changed now. First of all, he too has undergone the chthonic death experience by streaming underground. He will have been changed. And now he's on her ground, and they're now equal, river god and river goddess. It's fitting that they now come together. But we, you and I, having come together this evening under lamplight, must now go our ways, and may we flow abundantly wherever our waters lead us. I'm Robert Louis Abrahamson, and this is Cambridge 105 Radio. And here are Gladys Knight and the Pips to take us out with a comforting song about the healing properties of divine feminine living water, leading us where peaceful waters flow.
Someone to turn your world